Broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain, BC, we are CJSF 90.1 FM, and we are diverse, independent, and yours.
Hello and welcome to Viewpoints on this week's show. Susan Holt was sworn in as New Brunswick's first woman premier.
It's a dream come true to be able to serve the province that I love. It has been the best days of my life.
Words will have consequences, says Cecil Clark, Cape Breton's regional municipality and newly elected mayor. He vows to tackle racism and homophobia in the province.
We cannot allow the hate to exist or persist in our world, and we have to call it out.
The Chocotin National Government and Museum of Vancouver partner up to repatriate long-lost ancestral belongings.
It's just really awakened a lot of questions in them about some of this missing knowledge that's in their community and how they're going to maybe go about bringing it back. It's really a beautiful thing.
We'll go green and talk about microforest planting in the center of Montreal and over to Ontario, where we hear about the butterfly Flyaway project, giving insects, butterflies, and bees a helping hand.
If something is eating my garden, I am super happy. Worldwide, we have lost 40% of our insects.
And also in Ontario, some volunteers gather to save the Halliburton gold trout, one egg at a time.
They grow and they go into tanks and then bigger tanks. And 18 months from now, these guys will be stocked into Halliburton lakes. I mean, this is a healthy fish here in this lake.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Nice to have you with us. Happy to be here. My name is Boris Chassaigne, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Well, New Brunswick's political history was made official last Saturday with the swearing-in last weekend of Susan Holt, the first woman to hold the position of premier. Holt was visibly emotional during the ceremony, especially so when swearing in the five women who will work in her 19-person cabinet. The new premier invited dozens of women in leadership, past and present, from across all parties to be in attendance, saying, "I would not be here if it weren't for them," when addressing reporters. The 61st New Brunswick legislative session is set to begin on November 19. Priorities for the new government include reversing the changes to Policy 713, which forbid teachers from respecting name and pronoun changes of students under the age of 16 without parental consent. Priorities also include repealing Regulation 8420, which excludes abortion from Medicare coverage, as well as imposing a provincial rent cap by February 1st. One of our newest collaborators, Johnny James, based in Fredericton, New Brunswick, has that story for us.
Shortly after 2 p.m. Atlantic time on Saturday, Susan Holt became the first woman to be sworn in as Premier of New Brunswick.
It's a dream come true to be able to serve the province that I love, and people have responded and expressed to us the hope that they're placing in our team, the hope that they're feeling for our province and its future. It has been the best days of my life.
Holt was visibly emotional during the ceremony, especially so when swearing in the five women who will work in her cabinet. The new premier also had multiple women in leadership in attendance from across all parties, and gave them a moment of recognition during her acceptance speech.
I would not be here if it weren't for them. The women who came before me paved the way, and every single one of them that got elected made it a little bit easier for the next of us to get here.
Of her 19 cabinet ministers, only two have previous cabinet experience, and 10 are first-time MLAs, which Holt said is intended to bring new voices to the table.
We need to do government and politics differently. We need new perspectives and people who are going to think about things differently and who bring fresh eyes to the work of government, because that's what New Brunswickers told us. They don't want status quo, right? They want a government that's going to be out there, open, transparent about the work, and involving New Brunswickers in the work. And so you'll notice that the cabinet that you have behind you are people who have done a lot of community-based work. They know how to partner with municipalities and stakeholders and local organizations and do the work on the ground that New Brunswickers are asking for.
When asked about the response to her campaign, which resulted in a 31-seat majority, Holt said that New Brunswickers want to come together.
We are not a divided province. They saw our message of positivity and of hope and a really balanced approach to deliver a fiscally responsible government that's going to improve healthcare services. We were focused on New Brunswickers' priorities. We were out in communities listening to them, and we put forward a team of people who are leaders in their communities, who are working hard to serve their neighbors. I think New Brunswickers responded to that message of coming together and responded to these amazing people.
Holt's cabinet is set to meet for the first time today, with the legislative session set to begin November 19th, with top priorities being undoing the changes to Policy 713 that forbid teachers from respecting name and pronoun changes of students under the age of 16 without parental consent, repealing Regulation 8420 that excludes abortion from Medicare coverage, and instilling a provincial rent cap by February 1st. I'm Johnny James.
To the neighboring province of Nova Scotia now, where Cape Breton's regional municipality mayor, Cecil Clark, told a large audience at the council swearing-in ceremony that racism and homophobia won't be tolerated. Clark says some newcomers are already contacting him, looking for help dealing with racism, and this is because they feel there's nowhere else to turn. Clark says he was victim of homophobic slurs during the recent municipal campaign because of his same-sex marriage. Clark says the council will work with police to decide what the consequences should be for targeting someone's sexual orientation or ethnicity. He says curbing racism and homophobia are among other civic priorities, such as encouraging constituents to be more engaged with the local government, given a drop in voter turnout. Details with Bill McCush in Sydney, Nova Scotia.
Mayor Cecil Clark and the CBRM's 12 councillors were ushered into the swearing-in ceremony to the familiar Cape Breton sounds of drums and bagpipes. About 200 people attended the event to hear Clark's first official speech as mayor. As he spoke about council priorities for the next four-year term, he said those priorities include curbing racism.
Our service has to rise above ourselves to serve the citizens of our community. At a time where we see great opportunity and growth, yet we're impacted by challenges that face us on a daily basis. And some of those challenges, quite frankly, are despicable. And we have to face things like racism head on. We cannot allow hate to exist or persist in our world, and we have to call it out.
Later, Clark spoke with reporters to follow up on council's concerns about intolerance in the community. Clark says some people are reaching out to him personally for support.
I understand the volatility in the world right now and that people feel they can say anything without consequence. That's just not the case. And people taking something the way they might have thought it was funny, it was far from funny. And at the same time, for me to have people writing to me asking me to help them from racism because they feel attacked and threatened in the community as newcomers here, I will address those issues. I'm responding to individuals that are pleading for help, and especially individuals that have come here from away that just feel that they have no recourse or where to go. So this is going to be a very serious discussion with our police officials, but also it's an all citizens aspect.
Clark was asked if the focus on racism has anything to do with a weekend Halloween party at a local fire hall. A few people showed up wearing KKK costumes, resulting in a social media backlash condemning the act. Clark responds by saying racism in general is cause for concern in the community, not to mention he personally has been the victim of hateful comments because of his same-sex marriage.
It was going to be a point by virtue of I made commitments with people that reached out to me during the campaign about their fears around what was happening on the streets and people being harassed, and I've witnessed it myself, of people being verbally assaulted and said, quite frankly, heinous things to them. And to have a senior citizen on the Esplanade come to me after I knocked on the door and start talking about how she just gets upset, how people in the building would talk about my being gay or queer and that and talking about black people in a very derogatory way. This has to be addressed. It's an all-ages issue, and it's not acceptable in our community, and I think we need to send a very clear message that we are a welcoming community, we are a community that includes all, and we will not tolerate this. We're in a world right now that feels that words don't have consequence. Well, there will have consequences in the CBRM.
Clark says homophobic slurs shouldn't be tolerated either, and that he was targeted while campaigning during the recent municipal election.
I've come through, like I say, the previous election, and I'm used to putting up with crap from people throwing homophobic crap my way. I don't have to tolerate that, and I can speak it out. And as I said, the silent majority has got to gain a voice, and this community's got to say that we're here for everyone to be welcome, safe, and we're accessible, and we're going to be a pride of place community, not one of fear.
Clark says he wants the community on board with their efforts, and council will work with the police to figure out what the consequences should be for people who attack someone's sexual orientation or ethnicity. Meanwhile, Clark says council has other priorities for the upcoming four-year term, such as getting more people involved with local government. Voter turnout is down in the recent election, and Clark says that means council needs a better connection with the community and more positive interactions.
Look, whenever you have lower voter turnout, you could almost feel it in terms of going around, knocking on doors. You get a sense that there was almost a certain apathy, and there was a certain frustration. There's angst in our community. And so from the point of view of over 10,000 less people voting this time, statistically, it's a question to ask, because the clerk's office, in fairness, all of the information went out a good in terms of letters with pins, where to vote, how to vote. It was a great ease to be able to vote. So the fact that people didn't, that's something I think that mayor, council, and the CBRN as a whole have to engage more. We have to be telling people how important these issues are. And maybe there's a level of what we have to do is just to get, when I say get back to basics, get back to informing people about the things that matter to them on a daily basis and prove value by being there and out in the community as I plan to be.
Voter turnout was 48.3% in the recent election compared to 2020's 51.3%. For the Local Journalism Initiative, Bill McCush.
Do you have questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
Out west to British Columbia, the Chocotin National Government and the Museum of Vancouver are partnering up to repatriate ancestral belongings. Over 60 ancestral belongings have been returned to the Chocotin territory in British Columbia so far. Sharon Fortney, the senior curator of Indigenous collections at the Museum of Vancouver, says that repatriation of artifacts is a key part of the museum's mission. Many of the items returned to the Chocotin custody can now be viewed at the Chocotin National Government Nassikox office in Williams Lake and the Chocotin National Government. More on this story with Jesse Winsloff in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Over 60 ancestral belongings have been returned to Chilcotin territory in the central interior of British Columbia through a partnership between the Chilcotin National Government and the Museum of Vancouver. A delegation of elders, youth, children, women's council members, and former Chilcotin leaders traveled to Vancouver to collect the items and bring them home. Sharon Fortney, the senior curator of Indigenous collections at the Museum of Vancouver, says that this particular round of repatriation is the culmination of a long process.
Well, that grew out of a previous repatriation we did with one of six of the nations there. The other repatriation had been undertaken like 11 years previously, and it was actually ancestral remains to one specific community. At the time that work was done, they weren't ready to complete that repatriation. So we kept reaching out to them, and eventually they came to a place where they were ready to move forward. And while they were visiting us with elders and other knowledge holders from their community, we have like a big research table in our storage area, and the shelving directly behind it actually held several Chilcotin baskets. So community members were really like, they were looking at them, and they actually expressed to us that they didn't have any of those baskets back in their own community. Like maybe they'd been gifted four back by the government for some work they did, but generally they were absent from their communities.
Fortney explains that the repatriated items, including 29 coiled root baskets, 29 stone artifacts, a birch bark knife sheath embroidered with dyed porcupine quill, and one pair of snowshoes made from rawhide, sinew, and wood, are much more than simply objects or artifacts to the Chilcotin people.
There's a lot of knowledge wrapped up in sort of material belongings, and it's not, we might look at it as just a functional object, but actually there's a lot of knowledge around how people use their land, where they went. When you're harvesting roots, they might not be available everywhere. Some of the decorative materials, it might tell us something about climate change and resource management in those territories. It's also for the young people. It's a source of community pride. I think it's just really awakened a lot of questions in them about some of this missing knowledge that's in their community and how they're going to maybe go about bringing it back into practice, which I think is the, you know, part of healing and recovery. So it's really a beautiful thing.
The repatriation of artifacts is a key part of the Museum of Vancouver's mission and ongoing efforts towards reconciliation, representing a shift in philosophy for the Museum of Vancouver and other museums with collections of Indigenous artifacts.
The Museum of Vancouver is a nonprofit, and our role is to care for the City of Vancouver's collection. So the collection is close to 80,000 items, and about a third of them are Indigenous belongings, not just from our province, but from around the world. So we have collections from the South Pacific, Africa, South America, other parts of Canada and the U.S. So we have a collections policy that tells us our responsibility to the city for caring for their collection, and repatriation is part of that policy. We are still collecting, but we are the Museum of Vancouver. So in the past, the museum was started in the 1890s, and it was started by settlers who came from colonies all over the world. And that's why the collection is really diverse. And so you can't collect forever. You run out of space, you know. So it's really about what are the priorities of the Museum of Vancouver today. One of them is like redress and decolonization. So we are very open to repatriation requests from Indigenous communities, but we're also like reshaping the collection through our contemporary collecting. So most museums, they don't have very much money to do that work, but, you know, we get a little bit each year, and we try now, if we're going to collect Indigenous made objects, we're looking at things that sort of are made by contemporary people, maybe artists, practicing artists that are made for sale or document some sort of an activity that they want to document. And so we're looking more towards host nation communities, Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh, and also Indigenous artists whose stories connect them to Vancouver. So we like have, for example, a few hundred pieces in our Plains collection. But what does that tell us about life in Vancouver? It doesn't tell us anything, right? So we are very open to repatriation requests from, especially from communities outside of the city.
The Chilcotin National Government and the Museum of Vancouver will continue the partnership that led to the repatriation of over 60 items, with the development of a new collaborative exhibit at the Museum of Vancouver to showcase the repatriation as an example of successful collaboration surrounding the repatriation of ancestral belongings.
They wanted to continue their relationship with us. And one of the plans they have for their belongings that they've repatriated is to share them amongst the different communities. And also they want to encourage other museums, I think, to do repatriation. They also want their community members to be aware of what repatriation is. So they wanted to do an exhibition with us. So it'll be under the title, The Work of Repair. So one component of that exhibition will be just about the celebration of the Chilcotin repatriation. And they filmed and photographed the baskets. They're still discussing with their representatives what they want to see actually in the exhibition, but there will be probably a film about their repatriation journey with the Museum of Vancouver. And then these beautiful photographs of the baskets touching the ground where they were, you know, made and came from. Like that was a really important thing they wanted to do with them. And then they're applying for funds to eventually travel that to little museums and in surrounding communities where it can be shared widely in the Chilcotin area.
Many of the items returned to Chilcotin custody can now be viewed at the Chilcotin National Government DAZICO office in Williams Lake. And celebrating Chilcotin repatriation will be part of an exhibition entitled The Work of Repair, Redress and Repatriation at MOV, which is scheduled to open in the spring of 2025 at the Museum of Vancouver. Jesse Wensloff reporting.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrim, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints. Follow us on X at Frequency News. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
To Ontario now, where members of the Haliburton Highlands Outdoor Association recently met to collect the eggs of Haliburton gold trout, a fish found only in Haliburton County. They are working almost every year to ensure their survival by raising the fish at the hatchery. The Halliburton gold trout is what's known as a relic fish, meaning it was trapped in the area by glaciers during the last ice age. The annual egg collection is a partnership between the Ministry of Natural Resources and hatchery volunteers and gives the fish a far better chance for survival. They have a 90% survival rate when raised at the hatchery compared to only 1% if spawned in lakes. Here's part of Elizabeth Oakley's report. She's in Halliburton, Ontario.
On a clear Saturday morning at Halls Lake in Halliburton County, a small army of dedicated volunteers are carrying out a specialized mission. It's what members of the Halliburton Highlands Outdoor Association are doing to ensure a species of lake trout continues to thrive in the region's many lakes. Together at Elvin Johnson Park, the group is gathered to collect eggs from fertile females to improve the survival of the Halliburton gold trout, a fish found only here in the county. Dave Moss, who heads up the egg collection, explains how the process works and why it's so critical.
We will tend to get between 10 and 15 guys that'll come out for one of these. So we set up around 4 or 5 in the afternoon, and we're here till 2 or 3 in the morning in the dark and the cold. And the ministry guys just keep bringing us fish, and hopefully we get our maximum number of eggs we're allowed to take, and we pack up and go home.
While the process seems simple, there are a lot of moving parts, and everyone must work together to ensure the fish are well cared for throughout. Dave says the delicate job of collecting the eggs is well worth the effort.
You've seen them out in the boat, and they'll come back in. They have an aerated tank on their boat. They'll bring the fish to us here, and you'll see we have two tanks, one with an M on it, one with an F on it. And we will, terminology is sex the fish, and it's either a female, it's got eggs, or it doesn't. And they'll go into those tanks, and then we'll take the female fish into the trailer, we'll measure it, and then we'll extract the eggs and get her back in the lake as quickly as possible. And then we'll grab two males out of the male tank, and we'll use a squirt from each one into the eggs, and then it's a matter of mixing them up with a feather. From the beginning here, there are buckets of water that we bring from the hatchery. So these eggs will be in hatchery water right from their beginning. And then they'll go into another solution that they'll sit for about an hour, and that hardens the egg. And then we have a method of counting them, and we count each little bucket of eggs and record it. And when we get the number we want, this year it'll be 4,500 eggs, I believe, then we will take those eggs back to the hatchery where we have specialized trays that they go in, and that's where they'll go. And every day they're checked. If there are dead eggs in there, which are white, good eggs are kind of an orangey color, then they'll be picked out and recorded how many, because not all the eggs survive. Around the end of November, I guess, you'll start to see a little black dot in that egg, and that's called eyeing up. The fish is developing inside the egg. Around the 15th of December, all of a sudden they'll start to wiggle around, and we have, they're called sac fry. And they will live off their egg sac for 2 or 3 weeks. And during that time, we will start to feed them so they will get used to artificial foods. And from there, they grow and they go into tanks and then bigger tanks. And 18 months from now, these guys will be stocked into Halliburton Lakes.
David Poirier knows a lot about fish. Prior to retiring, he worked for the Ministry of Environment in a lab where he checked the health of the fish. Now as a volunteer, he's the hatchery manager for HHOA, and the thrill of helping fish flourish never gets old.
The rewards of the group's hard work today will be felt years to come, from appreciative comments from anglers to donations to the club and more volunteers eager to help out.
I mean, this is a healthy fish here in this lake, very, very healthy fish. So I don't think that they're becoming less and less, but it's just that we're giving people around the county an opportunity to sport fish for these, and that's good for tourism. We get all kinds of people that'll come to the hatchery and volunteer. The community, I think, really embraces how special this place is.
At day's end, volunteers celebrated meeting their goal, collecting between 4,500 and 5,000 eggs.
You're listening to Viewpoints.
And we stay in Ontario, where the Butterfly Away Project is encouraging people to help butterflies and bees by giving out seeds to grow native flowers, which are needed for butterflies, bees, and other insects. The Butterfly Away Project was started by the Suzuki Foundation many years ago and is active in Eastern Ontario through the Eco East environmental organization. Shauna Wanamaker, who leads the Butterfly Away Project, explains how landscaping and native flowers and grasses reduce mowing and monoculture lawns, and getting away from non-native cultivars can improve the survival of pollinating insects. Here's a very short excerpt of Candice Vetter's conversation with Mrs. Wanamaker in Carlsbad Springs, Ontario.
It does seem to be growing as a movement across North America. Our region started in 2022. I was introduced to Christina Enright, who is a monarch specialist, and she's also a butterfly ranger in North Stormont. She just inspired me to get involved. I learned so much. It completely turned my gardening world upside down, because I would often wander through my garden wondering, where are all the insects? And the one thing that caught me once when I was listening to her speak was the fact that she said, if something is eating my garden, I am super happy. And at that point, I didn't understand the loss of insects and our loss of habitat. And I was like, this lady's crazy. Who wants bugs eating their garden? Since then, I have learned that worldwide, we have lost 40%, I think it's now 41% of our insects. And without insects, our world is not going to function properly. And that loss of insects has come from the loss of our native plants, because there's so many cultivated versions out there that do not feed our insects the way they need. The roadside cutting is a huge issue. I'm witnessing it even now, wondering, why are we cutting down the tall grasses? It's not even tall, but the asters and the goldenrods that our migrating insects need, when those grasses could easily be a snow fence for humans as well. So I don't know what the drive is, but we have this incessant need to clean up everything everywhere. One of my roles as a ranger is to educate not just about native plants, but the impacts that humans are having on our environment.
And to close the show, we stay on our green path as we move to the Notre-Dame-de-Grâce NDG West Island Borough in Montreal. That is where Japanese botanical ideas are making a breakthrough. A slope of the corner of Upper Lachine Road and Girouard Avenue will be getting an experimental microforest project. A microforest is when a wide range of trees and vegetation are planted in a concentrated area. Microforests are inspired by the Miyawaki method. The method generates a fast-growing forest in a small urban area. This is a first for the Notre-Dame-de-Grâce NDG area. Adam Innes in Montreal, Quebec.
The plan is still in the public consultation phase. The community council is asking community members what they hope the microforest could look like, what plants it could support, and fielding other ideas from the community. Here is the community organizer for the NDG Community Council, Aries Kalafoutis, speaking about what excites him about the project.
These trees, in combination with a variety of flowers and bushes, are part of the process that makes microforests very effective, which is a process by Japanese botanist, and growth of forests, of trees and plants, is accelerated almost to 100% when you combine all your different species together and you really clump them in a small area.
There is no clear timeline, but the section has been approved for planting as part of the NDG 2023-24 participatory budget.
That that's it for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to all our journalists this week: Elizabeth Oakley, Jesse Winsloff, Adam Innes, Candice Vetter, Bill McCouche, and Johnny James. And to our national editors, Conrad Fox and Victoria Fenner. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassagne. Many thanks for keeping us company this week, and hopefully until the next. Ciao.